Welcome to Paranormal Underground Radio. Join us each week as we delve into some of life's most complex questions. It's time to explore the unexplained with your hosts, Karen Frazier and Rick Hale.
It is Thursday night, and if you can hear our voices, you are exactly where you need to be. She is Karen Frazier. I am Rick Hale. This is Paranormal Underground Radio at hazyradio.com. Welcome. Tonight, we are not going to be doing the usual 15 minutes of banter and witticism. rather, our guest is already here with us, a very important guest, and I will throw it over to Karen, and she can tell you all about it. Karen?
That's right. Well, thanks everybody for listening. I am really excited to have our guest tonight. I think I have shared on this radio program that when I was about 14 or 15 years old, my father shared a book with me. And it changed the course of my life and everything I wanted to do, and has actually led and directed, not led, but it has been a big part in my work as an afterlife researcher. So we are really thrilled tonight to have the author of Life After Life, also many other books, including Paranormal, which is his autobiography. It's Dr. Raymond Moody, everybody. Dr. Moody, welcome to Paranormal Underground.
Thank you so much, Karen. I've been looking forward to this, and I'm really just honored and delighted that you would want to have me on your program.
Oh, it's great to have you. I have had, let's see, what's it been, about 6 weeks that I've had the Raymond Moody countdown going, Rick?
I would have to say that, yeah, and every week, you giggle like an anime schoolgirl, so it's like, it's not really funny, Dr. Moody, it's cute.
Well, I'm just really happy about that. You know, it's, I great deeply appreciate that, and I have had that same experience. It's the awakening of my fascination with it took place when I was 18, Karen, and about 4 years older than you were when you came across it. But I was at age of 18, I went to the University of Virginia with the intention of studying astronomy. And I had never been a religious person. I came from a family where, we didn't go to church or anything like that. And to me, my grandmother sometimes made sweet, not bitter jokes, but kind of humorous, poking fun at religious people and so on. So that's how I grew up, and I was fascinated with astronomy, and the idea of an afterlife was just not in the cards to me. Not something that was in my world view. I had decided early in my life that when you die, your body just rots and your consciousness vanishes. And I had gotten interested in philosophy in high school, so when I went to the University of Virginia, my first semester I took a philosophy course along with the other things, and literally just in the first few days reading Plato's Republic, which is, the name sort of hits with a dull thud with most people, like Boresville or something, but
no, not at all.
In reality, Plato's Republic, his most famous work, is a major statement about the afterlife and near-death experiences and so on. It kind of culminates in an amazing near-death experience that Plato had heard about. And so the fact that this guy who's really, Plato, I always ask my students in my introductory Plato courses, to try to account for the fact that this guy has been in print continuously for 2,300 years, and they all come up with the same conclusion, well, there must be something interesting in there. And it really, it is. It's just fascinating stuff. And anyway, because this amazing man he took the afterlife question seriously, that's why I got interested in it. So then, and 3 years later, in 1965, when I was an undergraduate philosophy student at University of Virginia. I met Dr. George Ritchie, who was a professor of psychiatry there. And some years before, he had been actually pronounced dead on two occasions, having his death certificate written out two different times on a 9-minute period. It's just really incredible that he lived. And he had told me this amazing story. And, I related to it in the sense that Plato had said similar things. And so then the fact that Dr. Ritchie was such an astonishingly wonderful guy inspired me. And then I went on and got my PhD in philosophy, and I began to hear these things from the philosophy students that I had, and also from the faculty members at the university where I was a professor and so on. And then by 1975 or 74, I had enough cases to write up the book Life After Life. But it's a life-changing, mind-bending thing to find out about that this stuff, and I'm honored that you've picked it up through me, and I had picked it up through Plato and George Ritchie. So it's just a matter of sort of sending the inspiration on, I think.
Sure. Yeah, I do. And I have to tell you, I actually was very similar to you, I guess, because I had decided the same thing as you. Nothing happens when we die. When you die, you're dead.
Yeah.
And, and of course, I grew up in the church. And so people would say, oh, no, you have eternal life. And I kind of thought, well, if that's true, I've been a pretty good person, so I should be okay. Mm-hmm. And if not, I'm dead and I won't know the difference anyway, so it's not a big deal. I mean, that was kind of my philosophy.
I
think it's fascinating that you came to this through philosophy, and you actually, before you had your MD and went into psychiatry and everything else, you had already come out with this book, correct?
Yes. I wrote the book while I was in medical school, and it was published just a couple of months before I graduated from medical school. But I had done, by the time I went to medical school in 1972, I had already done quite a bit of research on this, yeah.
Right. Well, didn't it feel like being in medical school, which is, of course, very, very linear in its thought processes, in a kind of a scientific manner, didn't being in medical school and coming out with something as risky as life after death, did that feel like a risk to you at the time?
No, it didn't, and I don't want to sound like a macho person here or anything, because I'm terrified, for example, of driving an automobile. I'm not macho, but that never did. No, I've always been, curiosity is a big driver to me, and when something captures my curiosity, I don't care what people think, but it wasn't anything courageous or anything. I, like I said, I already had quite a number of cases by the time I entered medical school in 1972,
right.
And so since I had gone the PhD in philosophy route and then was a philosophy professor, some of the people that I grew up with in Macon, Georgia, had already gone to medical school. I went to medical school in Georgia. Mm-hmm. And they were ahead of me, and they knew about my research. So by the time I came to medical school in September of 72, my friends had spread the word among the faculty that this student who was coming in September had done this work. And so very quickly, a number of professors, eight as a matter of fact, contacted me, and just in the very first few couple of weeks, and was really, saying thank you for investigating this, because about half of them had such an experience themselves personally,
mm-hmm.
and the others had heard it from their patients. So there was no real big act of courage, you know.
Sure.
Although, you know, it's pleasant to me to think of it like that. If people want to go on and think of it that way, I say, well, fine. It really didn't happen that way. No, and also when the book was published in 75, I full well knew by that time that anybody who was a medical doctor, for example, who read my book and had any doubts about it would quickly be able to resolve their doubts just by asking among their own patients, because it's a very common thing among patients who narrowly survive a close call with death.
Sure. And when you were first gathering your data, were you mostly just classifying the stories and sort of trying to work out the different common experiences?
Yeah, that was, you know, I am kind of an analytical thinker, and as I as I gathered all these cases, I mean, the similarities just became sort of obvious, you know, when you look at 10 or 15 cases, or, you know, which probably I forgot how many I had by the time I went to medical school, maybe as many as a couple of dozen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you have just that many, you can see the patterns. So, you know, I sort of talked about the standard patterns, where people say that, you know, when their heart stops beating, they can actually hear the doctor or nurse say, oh my God, he's dead, or words to that effect. And they tell us about leaving their physical bodies and drifting up and watching as the resuscitation attempt goes on down below. And then they tell us after a while of this, they go through a sort of a passageway of some sort and come out into an incredibly beautiful and brilliant and comforting light that just sort of palpably love and comfort, peace. They say that relatives or friends of theirs who died are there in spirit form to welcome mm-hmm. them through this process, and they talk about seeing their whole life in a sort of holographic panorama, which they witness instantaneously. And they tell us that, you know, when you see everything you've ever done, every action you've ever taken, everybody has that reaction. Especially me. This is not something I'm looking forward to. And yet people who go through this say it's a wonderful thing. I mean, you know, that it's very often they say that there's a being of complete love and compassion there that sort of helps them through it and draws their attention to certain aspects of it. And people say that, you know, whatever they had been chasing in their lives, I mean, personally, I've spent my life chasing knowledge. For example, I had a PhD in philosophy and an MD degree before I was 31 years old. Well, somebody who's my present age, 68, can look back at that and say, well, that was a very, very disturbed person. And it's true. You know, I mean, if you think about it, there has to be something really wrong with the person who would get their PhD in philosophy by the age of 24, which is what I did. But, and what that means is that, see, I spent my whole life with my nose in a book, and I'm still that way a lot.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that.
Well, you know, I mean, yeah, I was chasing knowledge, but you know, some people chase power or money or fame or any of these other things, but whatever you're chasing, they say in this review of your life that what you see is that what it's all about is love. Because they say in this review of your life, It's like when you see each action of your life, it's like you're looking at yourself like you're another person. And when you see each action of your life take place, then you are embedded in the consciousness of those with whom you've interacted. So if you see yourself doing a mean-spirited action, like we all have,
sure,
to somebody else, then you feel the hurt empathically and directly. Or if you see yourself doing a kind-hearted action, then you feel the good feelings. So people come back from this powerfully transformed. They say they just have no more fear of death because, you know, from them, this is just a transition into another dimension of existence.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dr. Moody, if I may, I've read a little bit into near-death experiences, and one of the things that I always found very fascinating about it is that a lot of people, when they come back from this, they have, you know, some kind of psychic ability. If this is true, why is this? Is it something that they've always had, or is it just something that they gained for coming, you know, that close to the other side?
Well, I really don't have a definitive answer on that, but I have a conjecture. Okay. And I have heard this from a lot of people back in about 1972 or 73, I guess. There was a woman named Frances Stokes who was a... my dad was a surgeon in Macon, Georgia, and I had given a talk on my work to the medical association meeting in that town, and one of my father's friends, who's another physician there, had a receptionist. Her name was Frances Stokes, and she was the first person I ever heard that you're describing from, and I like her description of it. Her experience took place when she was about 11 years old and almost drowned. And she had this phenomenal experience of seeing her body and reviewing her life and so on. And she said ever since that time, she had this way of picking up on what's going on with people and in a way that, you know, is not exactly understandable, or doesn't know exactly how she did it. And she said, for example, that from then on, when she would walk into an elevator with people, for example, you could sort of sense or feel what's going on with them. And which obviously, you know, that would have made her an excellent receptionist for a doctor, right?
Sure,
and,
of course.
She had that, she had that job for a long period of time, and I've heard it from other people, and there is an experience which we talk about in psychiatry called loss of ego boundaries, and it occurs sometimes in mental illnesses, but it can also be a good thing. I mean, in the sense that you know, we put a lot of energy in maintaining our ego boundaries. And there are certain kinds of things in life that just sort of make you give that up. And one is aging. You folks will find at age 68, as I am now, the whole perspective of life changes. And the way I like to put it is that I'm sick of Raymond Moody. You know what I mean? I mean, here I am, 68. I'm sick of me. All of my energy now is directed in basically toward my wonderful two little kids. I've got a 14-year-old and a 12-year-old. I got a wonderful 41-year-old and a wonderful 38-year-old, and that's great, you know.
Sure.
And but they're grown and they're on their own. And then I have a wonderful little grandson, but he's got his parents. But, you know, the ones that are depending on me now are the 14-year-old and the 12-year-old. And it wonderfully concentrates the mind to sort of cut down on your focus, if you know what I mean. And
yes.
And that's kind of what loss of ego boundaries is, that you give up all that energy you put into maintaining some sort of structure there, the ego, and it becomes steadily less interesting. As a matter of fact, it's finally, you know, the ego eventually becomes kind of a bore. Okay. And so I think that really, I've noticed a lot of people who have near-death experiences at a very early phase in their life seem to be very mature. Mm-hmm. To a psychiatrist, for example, interview them. When you see them, if you talk to a 20-something, you know, 20-year-old who's had such an experience, you get the feeling you're dealing with a much older person.
Sure.
Like in their late 30s or 40s, kind of, you know. And
well,
I think that's what it is. It's the older you get, the lesser you pay attention to your own stuff.
Yes.
And the more you pay attention to other people's stuff.
Well, and that makes sense, the loss of ego boundary, because really, it sounds like what people try to do through meditation,
mm-hmm,
or in,
mm-hmm,
Zen Buddhism or things, mm-hmm, like that. That's the goal.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a question about the ineffability, because one of the things that people seem to describe, and one of the common elements I believe that you have listed, is this sense of ineffability, indescribability. And I think you have two things. You have a person's description of their experience and what the person actually experienced. Do you think we just lack the mental framework to be,
yes,
able,
I do. That's a very good point. Exactly. People say, no matter how articulate they are, that, or however many languages they speak, or whatever they say, that they just can't describe it. This light, for example, or the feeling of love, is just so far beyond our ordinary world, that there are just no words. They can't put it into words. And I think it's the reason for that, as much as you're saying there, is that basically when you talk about life after death, the logic that we use for other questions immediately breaks down.
Mm-hmm.
Because it takes it entirely out of the framework of logic. You know, in logic, the sentence, there is life after death, is self-contradictory, right? Because what death just means is the final irreversible cessation of life.
Sure.
So if to say that there's life after death is to say there is life after the final irreversible cessation of life. And so it's outside of that framework, as you put it. It's like if there's a life after death, then everything else is off. You know, I mean, it's is brought into I guess equilibrium or something, because we don't have any way to talk about something that's totally illogical, or at least we didn't used to. And what I am just really, you know, I've kind of gone, grown relaxed about this, but it's nonetheless kind of, but I can do it because I am really confident of this. I think that that's no longer going to be a problem. I think that we have reached the point in our thinking about these things that we can now actually reformat the mind of people to think logically about things that up to now we've not been able to bring into the category of reason.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been for some years carrying on a study like this, where I've learned it's kind of an educational program. I take people through exercises and so on, and that it reformats their mind to think about life after death and other big questions in a totally new way. And so what is going to be the outcome of this is that I've been preparing people for some years now. At some point, just by chance, somebody who's been through this, you know, sort of learned this new logic will just happen to have a near-death experience. And when they do, I conjecture that, and I'm completely confident about this, that they will be able to talk about it in a totally new way. So there are entirely new ways of investigating the near-death experience now, which involve actually preparing the people's mind before they have a near-death experience, so that when later on, just by chance they do, they'll be able to talk to us about it in an entirely new way.
That's pretty cool.
Interesting.
So in the after the I've read the work of a lot of people who do just I kind of lump it all together as afterlife research, and I know there's all these little areas of it, but you know, Gary Schwartz is doing stuff down at the University of Arizona with the, the mediums, and you have the parapsychologists who do what they do, and you have your studies into the near-death experience, and then the works of like Michael Newton and Brian Weiss into the life between lives things. And it feels to me like with the framework that we have to think about things, that we get ever closer and closer and closer to being able to make that, instead of making a leap of faith and saying there's an afterlife, that we can actually conclude it. But it's like that ball that bounces and it bounces and bounces and bounces and it never stops because it's always half of it and half of it. So you're getting, do you know what I mean? You're getting closer and closer.
Yes, very good description,
So you think then that if people can change the way they think, do that, we then get to the point of proof? Because I don't believe we're at the point of proof. Do you?
No. I think that, you know, I think whenever you see somebody waving the banner, you know, of proof of life after death, you better be careful. You know, it's, I mean, this is an enormously difficult question, and so I agree with you. I don't think it's yet proven, but what I think is that two things are happening simultaneously. That I will put it this way: I am completely convinced, with all my conservatism. I mean, I hate to use this word because it's been so distorted by people who don't even know what it means, but the skeptical movement is a, is a movement of ancient Greek philosophy, and that was formed by Pyrrho. And ever since I read about him in college, I am basically a Pyrrhonist in many ways, and he was the founder of the skeptics. But what people, you know, the people who've taken up that label, they don't even know what it means, really. I mean, I am a really very dyed-in-the-wool, I suppose, skeptic, because it works. It's a very great inquiry method. But, and also, the idea of an afterlife is just very counterintuitive to me, not being a religious person, see, by origin. And so even with that, and so it's been to me a long, long, long process of sort of coming to terms with that. And that said, I will say that just in the past few years here, it's gotten to the point where when I look at all that I have learned, and I try to bring any other statement to it than just to go on to say, my God, it does seem to be that there's life after death, that I find myself, it seems that I'm trying to escape and to rationalize rather than just to go on and to say what seems to be straightforwardly the case. And let me explain. The way the traditional debate about near-death experiences has always been carried out, even going back to antiquity and the time of Plato, is that there's some people who look at it, at these things, and they're impressed by the similarities and how the change that it makes in people and so on. And so what they say is, well, you know, this, but they just go on and acknowledge that this seems to be an afterlife. And Plato would be in that category. But then on the other hand, there are these people who look at these same stories, mm-hmm. and they say, for example, well, you know, it says as the body is dying, the different parts die at different rates, and so that as the brain winds down and it creates these electrochemical disturbances in the brain and biochemical disturbances, that is reported by the patient. It's really just a hallucination cut off, right. You know, caused by the diminished oxygen flow to the brain.
Right.
Well, you know, that's the way it's always been debated. But look at this fact, and that is that as to those people who say, well, this can be explained by the oxygen cut off to the brain, we also know that identically these same experiences, every single element of the near-death experience frequently occurs, not just to people who almost die and return, but to the bystanders at the death of somebody else. For example, as grandma dies, one or more of the people standing there at the bedside may say that they feel that they leave their physical bodies, and they feel they rose up and accompanied their dying grandmother partway toward this light. Or people may say that they see the spirit of a dying person leave the body. I've even heard this from a lot of doctors and so on, or family members there at the bedside. Or people say that the room fills with light, even including cases where people have said that they have empathically co-lived the dying life review of a person who goes ahead and passes away. But sure. Now what I'm getting at here is, if the explanation of the near-death experience is that the cutoff of the oxygen flow to the brain creates a hallucinatory phenomenon, why would the bystanders who are not ill or injured have identically the same experience? You see, it doesn't make any sense.
No.
Right. Yeah, I actually find the shared death experience rather convincing.
Yes. And then, Karen, just a few months ago, I had something happen. I mean, it's just, I'm still reeling from this one. Maybe about 3 years ago, I went out west, and I met a really nice man who's an artist and also a successful businessman. And some little while before, he had had this horrific accident. A car accident. I have read the medical description and so on, and it's really, medically speaking, it's not possible that he lived. I mean, you know, it's just, you see things like that in medicine once in a while where it couldn't be that a patient lives, but they really end up doing it anyway. And so he was one of those. And in the horrendous accident, he lost both of his legs. His wife was killed instantly, and I believe one or two of his children. Mm-hmm. And he had this very powerful near-death experience during his cardiac arrest. And so as many people do, you know, he didn't tell his doctor or anything. People often don't say anything to the doctor. But he came back from this very beautifully. You can't even tell that he walks on prosthetics. He's very vibrant and energetic person. He's remarried, you know, he's a very happy, fine man. And so when I met him about 3 years ago, I said, you know, you really should write this up. if not, not necessarily for publication even, but just for you, you know, just to, as a, since he's in a creative occupation. So he took my suggestion, he wrote it up, and he sent it to me. It's a really good book, and being in the business he is, which is graphic arts, he had the facilities to make up his own little book, you know, which he did, and he sent it to me, and it was a very, very good book. So I read it and sent a comment, and just maybe a couple of weeks after he sent me the book, he called me back and he told me that in reading through his book, he realized that he had mentioned the name of the trauma surgeon who saved his life. And so he thought, well, you know, if by any weird chance the doctor would just happen to pick up this book and look, and there's his name in there. I mean, I guess, you know, it's kind of not exactly polite to mention somebody in a book and, you know, let them know. Mm-hmm. So just as a courtesy, he called the doctor, and he invited him to lunch. And when the doctor came, he explained that the reason he was asking to lunch was that when he had that, you know, when the doctor saved his life, that he had this powerful near-death experience, and he described it to the doctor. Whereupon, he said, the doctor became very subdued and solemn and said, well, I've never told anybody this, but that night you came into the hospital, I knew you weren't going to die because the operating room opened out into another dimension. And I talked with your wife who had been killed in the accident. Now, what I'm getting at here is any scenario that you can build around cases like this, you see, is going to sound kind of contrived compared to just going on to say, my God, there does seem to be something after this. Mm-hmm. That's my take on it. I mean, what am I going to say? That, you know, that this famed trauma surgeon who's, you know, an eminent authority, you know, had a hysterical episode at the same time his patient was having a near death. I mean, you know, that's
right.
That's just getting rather contrived.
Sure.
Yeah, it's more than a coincidence. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So Elaine has a question for you, and I wanted to ask it while she is in the chat room because it is her daughter's 21st birthday. Happy birthday, Courtney. And they are going to go out for her first legal drink, and I'm pretty sure I'm putting legal in air quotes. Anyway, so what Elaine wanted to know is if you think it's plausible that people who have disorders like sleep apnea may actually be having near-death type experiences on a regular basis and just thinking it's a dream because they're so near death during apnea.
I don't know. That's an interesting question. Now, I personally haven't heard any sort of I've never heard those two associated, so I don't know. I'm not saying that it doesn't happen. I just don't know. But that's a very interesting question. I would say, to sort of go on along that same thought, I think that there are plenty of other circumstances than being physically near death that can bring people into alternate states of awareness, mm-hmm. where they seem to glimpse some other state of existence. And even, for example, playing great music. I have a friend named Eric Pagani, who is a well-known concert pianist, or used to be. And Eric lives in Paris, and he's in addition to being a wonderfully known musician, he's a very well-known writer and psychologist in France as well. But Eric in 1988 told me of, he was performing a piano concert, and he said at a certain point in the music, this was classical music, there were, I think there were three pieces in a row, a total of 15 minutes. And early into the performance, he left his body and went someplace else into this light. And when he came back to his body with no sense of time passage, the pieces were over. And so I asked Eric, who's very sweet and modest. This is just one of those wonderful people you meet in life. You think, he must have had the greatest parents in the world. I mean, this guy is just the essence of sweetness. And so I said, well, Eric, did the audience seem to like the music? And he said very sweetly and modestly, well, oh, yes, they seemed to. Well, fortunately, his girlfriend was there with him, and she had been with him at that particular concert. And she said, well, as a matter of fact, the people were just yelling and screaming and jumping up and down and wildly applauding. But, you know, while he was playing the music, from his point of view, he was in this light. So he thought, well, you know, if this has happened to me, it's happened to other performers as well. So he asked among his operatic friends and singers and so on, and many of them related experiences like these. And also, I have a friend who's an astronomer at Harvard, Jim McElhaney, and 20-something years ago, Jim gave me this article about astronomers who had profound out-of-body experiences while they were gazing through their telescopes into the interstellar reaches. So in terms of the question there, you know, it's, I think that generally this is absolutely on the right track. I don't know specifically about sleep apnea, but I do know that there are other conditions as well that will wake people up to these alternative realities.
Well, there are experiences, especially with art and music, and that are transcendent. And I'm a writer and I'm a musician. And, you know, there's the concept of slipping into the zone, which is, and I'm sure as a writer yourself, you've experienced this.
Oh, absolutely, the zone. Oh, yeah, that's what it's all about, the zone.
Yeah, and so I, you know, I wrote an entire book and in three sittings, or actually in five sittings, about 18 hours apiece. And really, I don't have a lot of recollection of it because I was so had to go back and read the book to read what I wrote.
Yeah, you know, you might, after having that experience, it might be fun for you to go back and look at the beginning of the Iliad, which you probably read in college or something. But it once you've had the muse experience, it, you know, those first few lines where Homer is singing, "Sing to me, muses of," you know, it's like they really did, you know, they understood that it doesn't really come from you, it comes through you.
I always say that. Yeah, I believe that. Absolutely.
I do too. It's just really it's just an item of experience, really. I mean, that's how it is.
So I had a Life Between Lives hypnotherapy session. Mm-hmm. Somebody who was trained by Michael Newton. So I know that Brian Weiss does them as well, and I don't know if their protocols are similar or not. But one of the things that the hypnotherapist did with me is, of course, took me through the point of death of a previous life and into this life between lives. And while it was very real and understandable in the moment, since then, when people have asked me about it, I can't really describe it. And I think people think that I'm being coy or shy, and I'm not.
Yes, I know exactly what you mean. There are words fail under certain circumstances. They do.
Yeah. Well, so do you think that hypnotherapy is then something also that could simulate these experiences? Or is there a way you think, other than dying and coming back to simulate?
I don't know. You know, that's interesting. I too have had a friend of mine took me through some past life regression experiences, which were really quite different than I had imagined them would have been. So I was impressed, but like you, I just don't know what that was. It was certainly something very extraordinary and very different from what I had imagined. You know, the sort of lay view on this is that everybody is either, you know, Napoleon or Cleopatra, and you know, the only very suggestible hysterical people and all. And I know that all of that is not true, but I don't know what that kind of experience means. Yeah,
right.
Where I've sort of come to, you know, sort of, I guess, acquiesce in the idea that, yeah, there is a life after death. Counterintuitive as that still is to me, in a way.
Right.
But, you know, it wasn't really... My interest in the past life regressions more, again, I am such a boring person, really, in that all of the interest that I've known for came from basically just my interest in ancient Greek philosophy. And, you know, Plato was a reincarnationist, and Pythagoras claimed to remember 8 of his past lives. And so that was what awakened my interest in all of this. You know, it's since logic fails here, you've got to sort of come up with your own makeshift logical principles for dealing with something that's so utterly illogical as the notion of an afterlife, I think.
Right. Well, you did some research into reincarnation as well, didn't you?
I did. Like I said, I got interested in it. Then I was a psychology professor when a lot of the public interest in that was going along. So my students were interested in it. And so I took a lot of my students through past life regressions, too. And it's, you know, it's genuinely fascinating. It's also very difficult to draw any sort of inferences from it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. You know, Dr. Moody, I just wanted to ask real quick. It's funny how we always bring the word logic into it, like we're a bunch of Vulcans sitting around at a table or something.
Mm-hmm.
But is it logic because we're told to think that way? We're conditioned to think that way when the natural condition is to, you know, experience these things and believe in these things without logic?
Well, you know, that is an utterly fascinating question, and I'm going to respond to it by something that you guys might think that I'm just making this up or something, but
no.
If you want a reference, here is one good reference would be History of Greek Philosophy. A History of Greek Philosophy is sort of the standard academic work on the history of Greek philosophy, and it's by a scholar named W.K.C. Guthrie. Okay. And it's published by the Cambridge University Press. So that would be one reference I can give you to this. And what you can find by looking into sources like that is that the logic that we have and that we're using right now as we conduct this conversation is really came to us very clearly from the Greeks. And Aristotle was the first person to codify the logic that we're using. But logic came to us through a sequence of events. It took about maybe 200 years for it to be worked out. But the principle of logic, the basic principle of logic, was started with the person who is regarded as the father of deduction or the father of deductive logic. Okay. Was a Greek philosopher named Parmenides, who lived about 500 B.C. And his day job was that he worked in what you call an oracle of the dead. These were these Greek institutions were there were various ways they had of going to the other world to get information or to call up the spirits of the dead and so on. Right. And Parmenides worked in one of these institutions where his job was to lie stock still in a cave, essentially, and these places were built underground. And from his point of view, you know, he would lie there in the darkness and complete sensory deprivation, and it pass over in a visionary way into the other side. This was kind of a shamanic modality. And during one of his trips over to the other side, he was sort of abducted almost by a goddess who took him to this place where she sang him a song. And that song is the very first written out logical deduction. So, this is a very complicated story, but the end result of it is that there is no question historically, it's just a historical fact, that at least from the point of view of the people who invented it, Parmenides, that logic came here from the other side.
Oh.
Yeah, that's all. You know, it was by no means a, you know, it was something that, you know, his idea was that he just went over there to the other side and he got this insight, which then became the foundational principle of logic.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah, it is. It's just an amazing story. I tell you, if anybody, you know, again, philosophy, the name of it even has such a dull thud for people, but if everybody would be a philosophy major if they only would read about the, you know, the very beginnings of it, because it's just about the most amazing story of history.
Okay.
It really is.
Yeah, it's been a while since my college philosophy and logic classes, so... So, Dr. Moody, we need to, we're coming up against the top of the hour, and so we need to go to break. And
when
we come back, I actually want to talk about your work with the psychomantium, because find it fascinating. So stick around, everybody. We are talking to Dr. Raymond Moody, author of Life After Life and many, many other books. We will be right back. It's Paranormal Underground Radio on the Hazy Radio Network.
Hi, this is Cheryl Knight, editor for Paranormal Underground Magazine.
And I'm Chad Wilson, Paranormal Underground Magazine's publisher. Every month, Paranormal Underground Magazine explores the unexplained by examining topics that range from haunted sites to ufology to cryptozoology. We also spotlight investigators and researchers who continue to pave the way in a field that seeks to answer some of life's most complex questions.
If you want to read about topics like psychic phenomena, demonology, conspiracy theories, crystals and herbology, and much, much more, visit ParanormalUnderground.net and start exploring the unexplained today. Visit us today at ParanormalUnderground.net and get a 12-month digital subscription for 15% off the cover price.
Hey everyone, it's Karen Frazier. I'm here with my co-host of Paranormal Underground Radio, Rick Hale.
Hi everyone.
We invite you to join Paranormal Underground Radio on the Hazy Radio Network to explore the unexplained every Thursday night from 6 to 8 p.m. Pacific and other times in the flyover states.
Each week we talk with investigators in the field, researchers, authors, and experts about topics that include paranormal investigation, ufology, cryptozoology, and spirituality.
So please join us each Thursday at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern for Paranormal Talk with great guests right here on HazyRadioNetwork.com.
Do you want to keep up with what's going on at Paranormal Underground?
Then tweet us on Twitter at ParanormalUG.
Or follow us on Facebook at Paranormal Underground.
Meet us on MySpace, Paranormal Underground.
There's no need to be in the dark about what's going on at Paranormal Underground. Join us on your favorite social networking site today.
Hey, this is Karen Frazier, writer and radio host with Paranormal Underground. Since I wrote my book, Avalanche of Spirits, The Ghosts of Wellington in 2010, people have asked me what happened next. In my new book, Dancing with the Afterlife, a paranormal memoir, my Wellington story continues. Dancing with the Afterlife is more than the continuation of the Wellington story, however. It's also the story of a lifetime of afterlife research and paranormal encounters. What I've learned has changed my life, and it might change yours as well. To learn more about Dancing with the Afterlife or to read an excerpt from the book, visit dancingwiththeafterlife.com. Thank you.
Hi, this is Hazy, and you're listening to the Hazy Radio Network.
The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual hosts and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Hazy Radio Network, its affiliates, or sponsors. All shows are independently owned and broadcast for entertainment purposes only.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Paranormal Underground Radio at hazyradio.com. We are your hosts, Karen and Rick, and we have been talking to Dr. Raymond Moody. So, Karen, take it away.
Take it away. Back to me. Thank you, Rick. I'm sorry. Was that, how was my announcer voice? Was it good?
It was all right.
So, Jenny in chat, who is a good friend of mine and clearly knows where my brain is headed, asked right before the break if you could talk about the psychomantium and your experiences and what led to it and what it is, because Rick hadn't even heard of it. So I'm right there with her. I would love to hear about the psychomantium.
Well, again, illustrating my point that I am so boring, but this too is... something that is really essential to ancient Greek philosophy. And what this is all about is that there were sort of standard institutions in ancient Greece that were known as the psychomantions, or the oracles of the dead. Mm-hmm. There were four of these, the four most famous of them. Many Greek historians and playwrights and philosophers, and even the man who invented the study of geography, Strabo, and just on and on. You could give sources in the ancient Greek writings which suggest that they really had these places where the story is that if you had lost a loved one to death, you could take a pilgrimage to these oracles of the dead, which were subterranean facilities. They went actually down under the ground. So it's apropos that we're on the paranormal underground today, because this is definitely underground. And they had apparently taken natural caves and extended and built into them, so that these were huge underground places. And the stories, which you can read and, you know, just throughout ancient literature, is about these places. You could go and you could actually see and talk with your dead relatives. Well, when I was in college, this was very well known to have been a major influence in the development of Western thought and the philosophers or some, but there wasn't any archaeological findings. But in the late 70s, Sotirios Thakouris, who's a very well-known Greek classical archaeologist, just by trusting what he found in Homer and Herodotus and the other writers, found the most famous of the oracles of the dead. It's in the far northwest province of Greece, which is called Epiros. It's directly below Albania. And so he found it and he excavated it, and it was this huge complex of corridors and dormitory rooms and all opening out into a 50-foot-long central apparition hallway, which was apparently the room where you actually saw the spirits of the dead. And so what they found in there was an enormous bronze cauldron that was surrounded by a banister, indicating that when people saw the visions of the deceased, they were looking in the direction of the cauldron. So and there were carbon marks on the walls of this underground chamber, indicating that in antiquity there had been torches there, so it was lit indirectly by torchlight. And so Dr. Dakaris and the other archaeologists, when they found the big cauldron, they didn't really know what to think about it. They sort of figured that indications from the writers who wrote about this is that you went there and you stayed down underground there for 29 days. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so what the archaeologists thought was that, well, after having had these people there for such a long period of time, the attendants could kind of figure out what sort of person it was that they had come to see and would hide in this cauldron in this underground chamber and act out the role of the spirits. But being a psychiatrist, I had a totally different take on it because, I know that they still do this in the Middle East today, and it's a standard practice where they take a silver bowl, for example, and you can even read about recipes for doing this in the Greek magical scrolls that have survived from the, you know, several hundred years B.C. And you take that silver bowl or bowl of some kind and highly polish it on the inside and fill it with water and then a layer of olive oil. And in a darkened room, people would go through various procedures and they would actually seem to, by gazing into that bowl or whatever and dim illumination like candlelight or whatever, people would actually see full color three-dimensional visions. And I had known all about this also from my work in psychiatry. To make a long story short, as soon as I read that detail in the archaeological report, I knew what they were doing, and basically I just set it up and I found out it works. And
is it scrying? Is that what they're doing?
Well, it's scrying was the use of this for divination.
Okay.
But the way I did it was I set up a dark chamber, a darkened room, and I put a wall, put a mirror on the wall, and positioned a chair about 3 feet in front of the mirror, and positioned the mirror in such a way that when the person sitting in the easy chair in front of it looks up, they don't see their own reflection. And since the entire room is sort of darkened and so on, and there's a small light behind them, and when they turn on that light and sit in this darkened room, they when you look into the mirror under those circumstances, you don't see your own reflection, but it's like gazing into an optical depth, like you're gazing into infinity. So by reading the ancient documents, I sort of figured out how they did this, and I developed a procedure. I asked 10 of my graduate students of psychology, most of whom were older people who had already been out and had some career in psychology and were returning for further education. And then as knowledge, word about this spread, some of my medical and psychological colleagues began to sign on as subjects too. But basically what I asked them to do was to choose some one person that they wanted to see again who had died, and then they would come to my place one by one, and it takes all day to do this. In the morning, I would just get them to talk about the person who died and, you know, just go in a very deep way and to share the memories and bring up the, you know, not just the wonderful things about the relationships, but the sticking point in the relationship and so on. And after an hour or two of this, where they really get down and talk about the person very deeply, then I would conduct them into this chamber, and I would say, just sit there, get very relaxed, and gaze away into the mirror like you're gazing at an infinite depth. And I would leave them in there about an hour and a half. And under those circumstances, about half of the people on the very first attempt will actually have some experience, which they interpret to be, people interpret this to be a real event. They say, you know, I actually talked with my grandma. Some people see the vision of the deceased in the mirror, full color, three-dimensional, moving. Some actually say that the apparition seems to emerge from the mirror and come out into the chamber right in front of them, full color, three dimensions. Others will say, a la Lewis Carroll, through the looking glass, their experience is that their consciousness sort of goes through the mirror and they come out on an in an alternate realm on the other side of the mirror, and that's where they meet and converse with their deceased relatives. About one-third of the people will actually say that they hear the audible voice of the deceased. Almost all of the rest of them, the remaining 70%, say that although they did not hear an audible voice, they had a heart-to-heart or mind-to-mind communion with the apparition of the deceased. Most startling to me, as I said, people interpret this to be a real event. They are in a full state of conscious awareness, you know, it absolutely seems real. It's just like seeing and talking with the person. And most delightfully, I am not the only person doing this anymore. I sort of figured it out about 1989 and have been doing it since that time. But I've taught lots of other people to do it, and it's even taught at a psychotherapy training institute now. I taught the people there how to do it, and they've incorporated it in their curriculum as a sort of grief therapy for their PhD psychotherapy students. So yeah, it absolutely does work. It does.
Well, in your autobiography, you actually talk about an experience, a personal experience that you had when you were first figuring out the psychomantium with, I believe it was your maternal grandmother, your paternal grandmother. Would you mind talking about that?
Yes, yes. One thing I should say is that a certain percentage of people, it's probably about a fourth, who prepare all day to see one person, will, in the event, they will see some other person known to them who had died, rather than or in addition to the person they set out to see. And I was one of those. I prepared all day to see my grandmother, Waddleton, who was my cookie-baking grandma, with whom I had a really wonderful relationship. But the person who showed up instead was my paternal grandmother, with whom I had some real conflict. She was a very tough character. And I saw her just as vividly as just absolutely right there in front of me. I heard her voice. I felt her presence. She told me something about my childhood, which really made a lot of stuff make sense. I felt her presence. I think it sort of fixed up my relationship with my grandmother. I'm sort of jabbering here about mine, but so have a lot of other people had this same kind of really hard to integrate experience about this. That took place in 1991, I guess. Here, 22 years later, I'm still trying to put that together. And this is a continuing basis. Just within the past couple of months, I've had two really amazing people come here who went through it and had these, astonishing encounters with their loved ones who died. Now, another really neat thing that comes out of it is that it does seem to give people some alleviation from their grieving.
This is the second psychotherapy technique I've heard of where it helps people in a way that I would almost call paranormal with their grieving. The other one was something like guided, I can't remember what she called it now. We had her on our show too. I wanted to give people in chat the opportunity to ask some questions, and I know our producer Cheryl has some. So Cheryl, I would like you to come on and ask your questions of Dr. Moody.
Okay, great. I'm excited to do so.
Great, well, I know, that's Cheryl. Why yeah. I did.
thank you. Well, I really wanted to start off with my main question, and it has to do with with people who say that a near-death experience is nothing more than a product of a dying brain. And I wanted to know, what would you say to these people, or what do you say to these people when they say that that is the explanation for a near-death experience?
Well, what I say to them is I ask them, well, then, why should the bystanders at somebody else's death, who are not ill or injured, have identically all of these same experiences?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they say that they see the dying person leave their bodies, or they may say that they leave their own physical bodies and rise up and accompany their dying loved one partway toward this light.
Mm-hmm.
Or, and sometimes even saying that they empathically co-live the dying life review of the person who passes away. And I think those kinds of things are just very difficult to put together using that kind of explanation.
Mm-hmm. Right, because you have corroboration from, you know,
yeah,
people.
Well, you know, it's really the same experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, on that note, you've talked about people who have a near-death experience and have good feelings from it. You know, obviously they return, but they have good feelings. They may see departed loved ones. They feel, you know, a great healing light or something similar. I've read cases of people, and these are much fewer than are reported of the positive experiences, but of people who have the opposite experience, and they feel like they're in hell, maybe, or something like that. What do you make of that?
That was actually my question, but thank you, Cheryl.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. It's okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, I don't know exactly what to make of them, because, like you said, they are far fewer than the more positive ones, but not only that, the negative ones are also a lot more varied, that whereas the positive ones are very homogenous, the negative ones seem to be sort of all over the place, and there's three major kinds of negative ones, and I'm sorry, I always have trouble bringing that to mind, but what the three types are, but I do know that the rarest of the three negative types are the ones in which people say that they actually see hellish imagery, flames and so on.
Right.
Now, it's very difficult to make inferences about a smaller number, right? It's easier to make inferences about when you have a lot of cases of something. So I don't really know exactly what to make of that. I also do know that it's been slightly exaggerated, too, but there was a fundamentalist person some years ago who decided to jump into this debate to rescue Jesus or whatever, I guess. And he made the claim that, there were all these negative ones he had talked to, and he wrote a book about it. But a friend of mine who happens to be a conservative Christian cardiologist read this and thought, well, gosh, this is so different from what I hear from my patients. So he got in touch with this guy, and just out of, you know, genuine openness, just kind of figured, well, you know, what can explain the difference in our observations? And he said, this guy immediately began to backtrack and say, well, I didn't actually talk to all of them. I heard some of them on Christian television, you know, just, and then changing it all around. And so then later on, this same guy was quoted in another person's book as saying, you've got to scare people to convert them. So a word to the wise is sufficient. In other words, I think that, you know, and that's not to say that there haven't been legitimate works that do find some negative experiences too, but at least in one case, this was sort of distorted, I think, from a certain religious fanaticism. Mm-hmm. But now there's yet another factor here, see, and that is that I could easily imagine that if I had had a hellish near-death experience, I might be a lot more reluctant to report it. You know, I mean, it might be very embarrassing to say, you know, Doc, when I died, I went to hell. So it could be like an under-reporting problem, too. I mean, maybe that there are more of these negative ones and that people are just, you know, just reluctant to talk about it, perhaps.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The summation of that long-winded dissertation is, I don't really know.
Well, along those same lines, isn't there a cultural element as well? So, like somebody who is a Hindu, for instance, will have a different experience than somebody who's a Christian?
You know something, Karen? That is something that just, you know, strikes us even before we do any looking into it as somehow plausible or that it would probably work out that way. And certainly that's something that's often brought up by the so-called skeptics who say, oh, these things are culturally determined and so on. But just honestly, it's certainly something that doesn't jive with my own personal experience. I mean, I've traveled around. I've been to China, to Japan, to India, down into Africa, all over Eastern and Western Europe, South America, Mexico, U.S., Canada, and it's Australia. Everywhere I go, I hear basically these same things. Now, much as you're saying there, yeah, there is a, like, for example, when I was in India, people would say, they would tell me the same thing. You know, like, I got out of my body, I saw my body, you see this light, you see your life. And then in trying to grapple around for some sort of words, they say, well, it may be sort of like this thing in Hinduism and so on, but it's done within the proviso that there aren't any words anyway. So,
right.
So I kind of think that, and as I've listened to people from all over the world, I kind of think that it's, you know, that people say there aren't any words anyway, so I'm just going to borrow the closest ones that I can find, and they may be in my religious tradition, or they may be out, but I think it's basically the ineffability problem that we're up against here.
And so it has to do with our perceptual filters, is what you're saying then.
Plato said very beautifully, you know, he said, you know, the way we are in life, he said, it's kind of like we're horses wearing blinders. And that what keeps us here is that limitation, that we're in this circumstance and we don't see the whole picture. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Okay, Cheryl,
back to you.
Sorry,
I'll just get out one more question and then I'll make room for our guests. I have a question. Are you familiar with the work of Dr. Sam Parnia? He is an NDE researcher and the project leader for AWARE, as well as the author of the book, What Happens When We Die. And if so, he came out a couple years ago and said that an NDE might be an illusion or a trick of the mind. He didn't know, but he did say that. What do you think about that?
Yeah. Well, I would do him one further, and I would go on and say that an idea that has always been pretty high on my list of things, I think, since I was a kid, is that I kind of think this whole world we're in might be a trick of the mind. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's,
interesting.
It's real. The real problem we're dealing with here is the mind-body problem, which has never been solved. It goes back to Pythagoras. Like, how in the world, how in the name of God, is our inner experience of consciousness related to the material substance of the body? And the answer, in short, is we just don't know. Mm-hmm. But I haven't seen Sam Parnia's new book, but so I can't comment on it. But I am looking forward to reading that book. But I'll just have to say that what he's getting at there, I guess, is that we got to keep all the options open. Yeah, and the idea that near-death experiences more than any other experience are a trick of the mind. Well, you know, I think it goes far deeper than that. I think that our life experience has a lot of elements of it where it's not as it appears to be on the surface. I really do think that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever, when you're in college, you might have read Plato's Allegory of the Cave, right? That we're all, you know, we're very limited in our perceptions here, and we live in a world that is, to a large degree, illusory.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, we live in a world of our own making, because I think that our expectations often influence our perception. It's our filters. Mm-hmm. We all have filters based on experience and emotions and expectations and you know, all of that stuff. And we can't help but perceive the world we're in through that.
Yes, yes, it's a really exciting world that we're in here, I think.
So I did have a question from someone in chat, and he said that he hears the voices of the children that he saw die, and he wants to know if this is something that's common in people who have had near-death type experiences.
Heard the voices of children he saw die?
Yes, I believe that. Yeah, that's what he said.
Yeah.
I wonder what the circumstance was.
I don't know.
I think he said that he was in Iraq.
Oh.
Yeah,
so he was. So he's a soldier.
Oh dear.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, I guess that. I've gradually in my life gotten to the point too where it's I do talk to quite a number of people who just you know, very well grounded everyday people who once in a while have experiences like that of talking to people who've passed away. One of the sanest, most grounded people I know is our assistant of 22 years. She's a very, very wise and well put together individual who's had an amazing life story in this. And she doesn't set up a shop, you know, and do palm readings or set up a shop to talk with your dead relatives, but once in a while, I guess in the time we've known her, maybe about half a dozen or more times where she really can do it. But it's, you know, it's a spontaneous thing. You know, mm-hmm. It's not something she does on a regular basis, certainly not on a, you know, on a stage or anything like that. But it's really uncanny. And I've known a number of people over the years who have experiences like that where dead people tend to talk to them.
Yeah, Dr. Moody, yeah. I'm one of those people, so.
Oh, yeah, yes. And I,
yeah, they
you know,
do.
I accept that that's something that happens to people.
Yeah, well, All right. So Cheryl had one more question.
It actually just occurred to me after reading our discussion in the chat room. We've had quite a lively discussion tonight, and actually two members of our chat room had died and been resuscitated, and they had their own mm-hmm. version of a near-death experience. But one mm-hmm. of these people was describing how a relative was on her deathbed and she was having a conversation with her deceased sister. I want to know, yeah. how is that related to a near-death experience, or if maybe it's not related? What's your opinion on that?
I think it absolutely is related. Mm-hmm. I think that what we're dealing with here is a sort of spectrum of experience. It's very hard to find an exact dividing line. See, it's for example, it's very well known. Anybody who works with the terminal ill will tell you this, just as a fact, that within the in the last few days or hours of people's lives, they start talking to their dead relatives, and it's like they can see them coming into the room to take them away. And so you say, well, what is the relationship of that to the near-death experience? Well, if such a person was having such an experience and we resuscitated them and brought them back, see, this would be perfectly natural within that setting, too. People say they leave their bodies and their dead relatives are there to sort of escort them.
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes the bystanders at the bedside of the dying loved one will see these apparitions too. Mm-hmm. So I think we're dealing with a sort of continuum of experience, that it's all the same thing, but people see different aspects of it as to, if they're on the dying in the hospital room and they're talking with their dead relatives and then they do pass away, that's one thing. But if the person almost dies and we bring them back and they talk about seeing their dead relatives, see there, I think that's the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Okay. Hmm. Well, thank you for that.
Well, yeah. So I have one question that I always think about. So with all of these things, is the afterlife still in the realm of belief, though, or do you think it's a fact?
It's been a hard process to me. I wouldn't put belief behind it. What I would say is I'm stumped to come up with anything to put together all this stuff. I don't know what else to say except that it seems that at the point of death, we open up to some other realm of existence. For example, the case I said about the man who had his near-death experience and then the doctor simultaneously had this experience of the operating room opening into another dimension and talking with his patient's dead wife who was just killed. And I don't know what to say about that.
Sure.
What are you going to say? You're going to say, well, just at the time the patient who was having the cardiac arrest, the trouble was that his brain was responding to the diminished oxygen flow to his brain by creating this hallucination.
Right.
But then at the same time, his imminent trauma surgeon was saying, well, the operating room opened into another dimension and I talked to the patient's wife who was killed in the accident. The doctor, he didn't have a cut off of oxygen flow to his brain. You see,
sure.
Mm.
Yeah.
So that's just getting very, you would have to be rather caustic and abrasive, I think, a person to say, well, that doctor was having hysterical episode,
sure.
but the patient was just his oxygen-starved brain. I mean, that's just, that's, it seems to me a person like that is just trying to escape from addressing what seems to be a plain implication. Or I don't know if you've come, heard of the story of Eben Alexander.
Yes, I read his book, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing, too. For 15 years, a Harvard neurosurgeon who certainly knows all these theories, the epiphenomenalism, as it's called, that there's no independent reality to consciousness, that consciousness is just a secondary artifact of the brain function, which is regarded as the reality. And certainly that was Eben's world view.
Yes.
And yet, you know, he had this E. coli meningitis, which is virtually unsurvivable in adults. I think it's got a 97% mortality rate, and the ones who do come back are impaired. But, you know, there, Eben lapsed into a coma for a week, and the medical findings and the measurements show conclusively that, you know, by the current neurophysiological theories of consciousness, he couldn't have been conscious.
Right.
But, you know, from his point of view, he went to another world and kept seeing this young woman he didn't know, which subsequently he found out by seeing pictures was his sister
that
he didn't even know he had. I mean, these things are, you know, are, it's getting increasingly hard to think your way out of it.
It is. And Dr. Alexander's book is actually called Proof of Heaven, and it's a good read. So I would definitely recommend that for people listening who want to explore more about it, because it's fascinating. His experience was quite different than any of the other.
Well, it was, although, you know, it's in terms of the light and the visit to another dimension. You know, it's very similar. And the ineffability,
Well, ironically, my father gave me that book as well. So.
Oh, good.
Yeah, my dad's been a real force with all of the stuff in my life of getting me
well,
the information
tell him
I need.
Thank you, by the way, for doing that.
I will definitely do that. So, in about the 5 minutes we have left, Dr. Moody, I wanted to. You were at before we came on the air. You were talking about this amazing course that you're offering through RaymondMoody.org.
Yeah, I am not a business type person, but let me give you a website. It's RaymondMoody.org. RaymondMoody.org. And I have a wonderful friend who is, I've known him for 20-something years, who's just an excellent videographer. He's an artist. And about a year ago, it took us 8 months, but he and I put together a 15-hour internet course, and this is all of the stuff that I think is absolutely necessary for thinking rationally about life after death. So I put sort of everything I know about this into that course, and that he's just changing it to put up the you know, the details about how to get it and everything. And the more people that would listen to this and to react to it, the better for me, because I honestly think, and being very conservative and certainly not a confrontive person in any way, but nonetheless, I am willing to go on to say that I put that course together, and I think it really, it what it does is prepares people's mind to think rationally about the subject. And I think, I am convinced that it is actually a genuine breakthrough in the rational investigation of life after death. I want to sort of make that challenge. And if people can find, you know, breakdowns in my reasoning or to kind of show me that I made an error, well, you know, then, you know, so be it, and I learn from my mistakes. But the people I've had look at this who've been very rigorous critics have generally said, yeah, it does seem to work. So, you know, it's all sort of spelled out there. There's an introduction to it. So anybody who would look at that and who are really interested in this question, I think that I do have a totally new way of dealing with this.
Great. And I would also highly recommend your autobiography, which is Paranormal. Is it Paranormal, My Life in Pursuit of the Afterlife? Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And I actually have read it twice because I wanted to brush back up when you were coming on. I wanted to brush back up and read it again. Great book. And you talk a lot about other things that were going on in your life as you gathered all this knowledge, too. And it's a great look into your life.
Well, thank you so much. I always enjoy pointing out to people that I am a deeply faulted human being.
Aren't we all?
Like we all are, yeah. That's part of the fun of it, I think. I one of the things that again and again I've heard from people with these profound near-death experiences, if I can sort of put words in their mouth, but I think this is something that I hear from a lot of people in one way or another, and it's basically that life is not nearly as serious a matter as it seems to us from the framework we're in now.
Yeah.
That once we're out of this framework, it takes on a whole different perspective. And it's not really as serious as we think it is.
That is a perfect way to end our interview. Mm-hmm. Dr. Moody, it's raymondmoody.org. There's also lifeafterlife.com, right?
Right.
Anything else that where people can find your work or find you, or are those the two main ones?
Those are the two main ones. And what a delight it's been to talk with you three tonight. And also thanks so much to our listeners who are listening in.
Absolutely. It's been an absolute pleasure. And you are welcome back anytime, Dr. Moody.
Oh, great. Let's do it again then.
All right. I'll start my new Raymond Moody countdown.
Great.
Thank you so much, Dr. Raymond Moody, everybody.
Thank you, Dr. Moody.
You have a great
evening.
Looking
forward to talking with you again.
Thank you, Dr. Moody.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. There he goes, everybody, Raymond Moody. So in the last 15 minutes of the show or so, we have some things we need to wrap up. So, Cheryl?
Yes. Oh, wow. Wasn't that a great interview?
Yeah.
What's that?
That interview was great.
Yes,
good job, you guys. Good job.
Yeah, it was great talking to Dr. Moody. And Dr. Moody, if you're on the line, you're welcome to listen in, or you can hang up. It's up to you. We always forget to tell our guests when we're done with the interview that they're welcome to stay or hang up, whichever they'd prefer. So there you go. Anyway, great interview. You know, I was telling Rick before the show, oh my gosh, I had so many questions. It was almost a matter of not knowing where to start.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's just the thing, too. That's why I'm like, I'm going to maybe ask one or two questions, and this is all Karen.
Oh, I thank you, Rick.
Oh, yeah.
And thank you for letting me come on and ask some questions.
Of course, Patty awesome. Just texted me and said, so every time he says Karen, you smile, don't you?
Yes.
So that would be any better saying Karen. Yeah, I just absolutely fascinating. And I would recommend reading Life After Life. It's a new version. It's been updated many times. Mm-hmm. And then the other one, if you kind of want to know about all of the things, the past life research he did, the psychomantium stuff, that's all in his book, Paranormal. And
I just
downloaded it onto my Kindle, and you know, you can buy it on Amazon or anywhere where books are sold.
Yeah, I've read Life After Life many years ago. I need to maybe get the new version and get caught up. But the other one, the Psychomantium that you guys talked about, mm-hmm. I don't want to read about that.
You do or you don't?
I do.
I know. I want to do it. I'm sitting there as he's talking. I'm like taking notes and drawing charts and thinking, can I set one up in my closet?
That would be cool.
So say that you stumbled on this, like you got enough out of what he said, and you stumbled on it, and you set it up in your closet, okay? Mm-hmm. And you set it up in your closet, and one of the things people report is that nothing happens while they're in there, But later, this was Dr. Moody's experience, as he describes it, was nothing happened while he was in there. But later, he's sitting in his living room on the couch and his grandmother's standing there. What if you accidentally stumble on this and you actually manage to make it happen? And then you're sitting there, I don't know, with my luck, I'd be in the can or something. And, you know, your dead relative standing there.
I don't know.
I have seen my grandmother before, but it's been, you know, a long, long time since I've seen her. But I tell you what, I'm smelling a great horror movie from something like this.
For the psychomantium thing?
I could see that,
totally.
Too.
Totally. I mean, it's not your grandmother that you brought through, but it's something that Zach Bagans hunts on a weekly basis.
It's just, yeah, I want to experience that, the psychomantium. But, you know, I've worked with scrying a little bit, and I've never had any luck with it. But I also have never really had the patience for it. So, anyway. Okay, so Cheryl, contest.
Yes, yeah. Oh, before I forget, because I always think about it and then I forget, I want to thank our listeners as well as the people who come in the chat room regularly and chat and listen and ask some great questions. Thank you so much. We really appreciate
it. Thank
you. You guys rock.
You rock.
Yes.
I don't always answer your question or ask your questions the right way. You know, I try.
You do a good job. You do a good job.
We try, don't we, Rick?
Yes, we do.
You guys both
not as good as Cheryl ever.
Oh.
Okay, so we only have a few minutes, like, you know, 5-10 minutes left. And we have all this business that we didn't take care of at the top of the hour.
We do. We have a May contest. We're in May 2013. So if you're listening to our podcast in May 2014, don't enter. Sorry.
Or beyond.
I'm in a weird mood.
See, it's
okay.
Like May of 30, 35, and you
don't
stumble
enter.
Across this podcast, you will not win a prize.
This month's contest is simple. If you want a free issue or three of Paranormal Underground magazine, just email me at editor@paranormalunderground.net, and we would like to know what your favorite cryptid is, because we think that would be fun to know. And that's all you have to do. And we're going to have 5 winners, and the winners are going to get 3 issues of Paranormal Underground magazine. And if you already have a digital subscription, don't worry. You can choose 3 past issues that you don't have. Sweet. That's simple.
Nice.
5 winners,
that's right. And
3 magazines.
And we actually did have a near-death experiences issue long time ago.
Oh, my gosh. I think it was in
the first year of the magazine.
2009. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I honestly, I can't remember right now. I think it was in the fall, but I'm not sure. Don't hold me to that. But we did have an NDE issue.
Yeah, I remember writing it.
So join our contest. We want to know what people
week,
think of the
magazine.
Are we talking
to Darren next week?
Yes, we are. We'll be talking to Darren Thompson, and he's with Whisper. And what does that acronym stand for?
Washington State Paranormal Investigation and Research, I believe.
Actually, you're right. I just saw it.
Yeah. Okay. And they actually are the sponsors of the Pacific Northwest Paracon that's coming up here over Memorial Day weekend in Seattle in conjunction with Crypticon Seattle.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Wow. Are you going, Karen? Because you're close.
No, I'm not. I actually have some other things that I have to do. I wish I was. One of my necklaces will be there being auctioned off. So.
Oh, cool. Very nice.
Yeah. I know. It's for a good cause. It's for brain tumor research.
Oh, wow. That's a great cause.
Yep. Definitely. And it's one of the spider necklaces.
Ooh.
One of the, like, bejeweled spiders, like, you know, the sapphire. It's like a sapphire and a pink garnet spider, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So, there you go.
There you have it.
Awesome.
Yes, and then the following week, it's Thomas Fusco, right?
Thomas Fusco will return to the show, and we'll have a discussion with him. You both are going to be gone.
Oh, shame on us.
How dare you? So, we're going to have 2 guest hosts that night. We are going to have our publisher of Paranormal Underground magazine, Chad Wilson, with us, as well as our science editor, J.D. Harrison, and they will be talking about all kinds of cool stuff with Thomas Fusco.
It is going to be a totally geeked out scientific discussion, folks.
It is. Beware.
Yeah, that's right. So put on your smart caps, everyone. Because if Rick and I were conducting the interview, you know, it'd be questions like, what do you think?
Is the cosmic veil
three-dimensional?
Well, you know what, Karen? Actually, I mean, what the stuff that he talks about is a lot more, you know, a little bit more in your speed of things, because I am so not very good at the whole quantum stuff. and you know what, the whole quantum stuff. See, I just showed everybody just how intelligent I am.
There you go. The whole quantum stuff. So, any other announcements, Ms. Cheryl?
Wow, I think that's it. If people haven't checked out the May issue of Paranormal Underground magazine, I hope they do so. It's available online at paranormalunderground.net or at MagCloud. You just go to MagCloud and search for Paranormal Underground magazine. You can get a print copy there. And we always like to hear back from our readers about what they thought about each issue.
Yep. Oh, yeah. So William, our good friend William Becker, who was on last week and I missed, mm-hmm. has his class coming up this weekend. If you go to his website, Paranormal Insights, I believe there is still room in the class. It's going to be at the Sumter Bed and Breakfast, which was the B&B that was featured on Ghost Mind. Mm-hmm. And he just found out that they get to go on the Dredge, I think it's called, which was the big thing that they investigated with ghosts on it and stuff. So, yeah.
Very cool. I hope one day to go to William's class when I'm in the area.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really do. I wish I could go to this one, but again, I can't because I had something else. I'm looking up William's website, but I think it's paranormal-insights. I'm just going to have to type it in because I never remember, and it always takes me to his blog, and I don't want that. Insights, not his blog. Okay. Paranormalinsights.net. Wow, that was so hard, Karen.
It's all right.
Woo! So you can check that out. And also, if you just do a quick Google search for Pacific Northwest Paracon, you can find information about the big Paracon coming up in Seattle if you're in the area. Going to be a lot. Our good friend Elaine Davison is going to be there talking about paranormal safety and sharing her stories of horror about things that happen to people who are not safe.
Yeah.
People who don't wear body condoms when they investigate.
Some of her stories are just frightening, terrifying, mind-blowing.
They are. They are scarier than any ghost ever, right?
Yes, they are. Yeah.
Okay, so, hey, guys, we have come to the end of our show, and now what am I going to do without my Raymond Moody countdown? What do I have to look forward to now?
Hold the phone. He said he'd come back.
Yeah. I know. We should schedule him pretty far out so that my Raymond Moody countdown can last longer, so I have more to look forward to.
Okay.
Because this came on really fast.
Yes.
And you're working on those other ones, including, you know, one of the one on my list was Dr. Newton, but he gave you another name. Did you ever contact the other name? Did you get turned down there, too?
I haven't, but I will. And I'm still hoping maybe Dr. Newton will be able to have some time in the future, keeping my hopes up that it may happen. He's very busy right now, but he was very generous and sent us a referral to another researcher who we're going to contact. And
oh, man. Yeah. You know, so when I say, like, in my top five people to interview, that people will think that means that Raymond Moody was number five. They're actually in no particular order except that Eddie Vedder is number one.
I'll work on that for you, Karen. I'm sure he's had some paranormal experiences.
Well, so here's the thing. I know where he lives.
Ooh.
But you know where Eddie Vedder lives?
Sure.
Stalker.
I know, right? So here's what I'm thinking. When Tanner gets out of high school and goes off to college, I'm going to have some time on my hands. And so I'm thinking I may take up stalking then.
Oh, my God.
What do you think?
How about if maybe you just happen upon him one day out and about and you do an impromptu interview?
I'd rather stalk it because I have a long time on my hands. I mean, come on, I'm going to be an empty nester.
Well, we wouldn't want to lose you to stalking, Karen.
Well, no, I'll still do all my other stuff. You know,
he won't get caught.
All right.
Okay.
The average stalker just does not have enough time. You know, they're so busy stalking.
Right, and so I'm going to try and find a good life stalker balance.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're starting to scare me, Karen.
Well, good luck with all that.
Oh, my gosh. And now we really have come to the end of the show,
Yes, we
folks.
Have.
Thank you so much for listening. Thank you to our guest, Raymond Moody.
I was
thrilled. Can't wait to talk to him again. I stalked him online this week to brush up for questions. And, you know, hey. It was all good. So next week, you will all come back, right? Because we are going to be talking to a really cool guy, Darren Thompson.
And so,
I hope we're here next week.
I'll be here.
Here's the thing. I am starting my Darren Thompson countdown.
Okay. Hey, that's awesome.
It's 1 week to Darren Thompson.
Yeah, short countdown.
All right. I know. It'll be here fast. I'll try not to giggle like a schoolgirl.
All right.
Anyway, you guys will love Darren. Do come listen to him. He is an engineer in his real life, and he is a great guy, and he has a lot of good things to say. So with that, everybody, next week, same time, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern, and other times in the flyover states, it's Paranormal Underground Radio on the Hazy Radio Network. Thanks for listening. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
If you'd like to be a guest on Paranormal Ground Radio, email editor@paranormalunderground.net. Until next time, keep exploring the unexplained at paranormalunderground.net. Please join us next week for Paranormal Underground Radio on the Hazy Radio Network.